Okay, I am Steve Michelotti, and I am on the Azure Government Engineering team. And today, we're going to talk about leveraging open source on Azure Government. Now, I think what happens a lot of times when people see open source, that term means different things to different people. To some people, it might mean non-Microsoft. To other people, it might mean Linux or Java. To other people, it might mean Microsoft, they write open source stuff too. And so I think what happens is that term open source gets confused a little bit because that means so many different things to so many different people. What I'm going to show you today is that actually it can mean all of these things. So I am certainly going to show you some non-Microsoft things that are considered open source, but I'm also going to show you several Microsoft things that are considered open source. So when we use the term open source to talk about Azure or in Azure Government in particular, I'm intentionally making that term a little bit broader. It's going to mean, yes, some non-Microsoft things, but also Microsoft as well. We'll get into that a little bit more as we go through. Now, just a quick agenda. I'm going to do a brief talk at the beginning here. First 5 minutes, 5-10 minutes. On what is Azure Gov. Any talk I do on Azure Government, I really like to have this piece at the beginning, even if it's only 5 minutes, 10 minutes, because not every single person is always familiar with Azure Gov. I think it's really important to have that 5 minutes of context to understand the difference between Azure Government and Azure Commercial. Then we're gonna talk about open source at Microsoft, the big picture, and then I'll spend virtually all the time at the end showing several demos. So with that, let's get into what is Azure Government. So the main takeaway here when we talk about what is Azure Government is that Azure Government is its own sovereign cloud. It's its own instance of Azure. So we think about Azure worldwide, 38 regions across the entire world. No, Azure Government is its own instance of Azure Government, isolated data centers, isolated regions, isolated networking, isolated fiber, isolated environment for government workloads, whether it's federal, state, and local government, whatever the case may be. These data centers that are dedicated to Azure Government are operated by screened U.S. persons. And so that's important to make sure that we are within compliance for U.S. workloads. Also, all the data must always stay inside the continental U.S. We have geo-redundancy with multiple regions, multiple data centers, and this is extremely important to the infrastructure. 100% of federal cabinet agencies are on the Microsoft Government Cloud. So the Microsoft Government Cloud consists of Azure Government, Office 365 for government, 100% of federal cabinet agencies. All 50 states are on the Microsoft Government Cloud. 6 million users, 7,000 federal, state, local governments. Now, of course, this picture is of Azure worldwide, and I always like to include this, even though, yes, we're here today to talk about Azure Government, because this shows the world scale of Azure. 38 regions, 2 times the amount of regions to our closest competitor, and this also gives some context for it. You think about the billions and billions of dollars that Microsoft invests in the technology on the cloud, on billions of dollars in security, infrastructure, all those learnings contribute to the government cloud as well because it's running same technology. Now, narrowing that a little bit to the government cloud, we had 2 original regions. The 2 existing regions people think about most often are East Coast and Central. In addition to that, a few months ago, we had 2 more regions come on, similar geographic locations. These are what we call our DoD regions. These have a higher level of compliance. Specifically, we have DISA level 5 now for these DoD regions. That's a huge differentiator. And in a little bit later this year, we have 2 additional regions coming online that will also be part of Azure Government. So 6 regions is actually 6 times more than our closest competitor. So that's one important point. And another important point is that these regions are at least 500 miles separated from each other. And that 500 miles is a very important yardstick, because if there's some catastrophic event like a horrible earthquake or a terrorist attack or whatever the catastrophic event might be, you have the peace of mind knowing there's at least 500 miles separating those data centers. If you set your application up in a geo-redundant fashion, you have your data backed up in multiple locations, you will be fine, all right? So that is another huge differentiator for us. In addition to our regions, we have our express route locations. So express route, yes, sir. All right, question on the DoD regions.
Are they meant, like, are they dedicated to DoD only, or can other agencies?
They are dedicated. The question is about DoD regions. Are they dedicated to DoD only? Yes, they are. Okay, and I'll talk about those just in a little bit more depth. But the express route locations, these are dedicated for government customers. So some cloud competitors may use their express route, kind of piggybacking on their public infrastructure. We don't do that. We have dedicated government express route locations, meet me points. Express route is technology whereby you can get your data center to securely connect into Azure, a dedicated fiber, and this allows you to securely connect your data center to Azure. So express route, huge kind of gateway into the cloud. Compliance. Obviously, when we talk about government workloads, this is a huge deal. And frankly, Azure Worldwide, you can see we have 53 compliance offerings. Now, these are worldwide compliance certifications. The ones we care about from a government audience is that second row there where it says US government. We have FedRAMP moderate, FedRAMP high. We have DSIL level 2, 4, and 5. And of course, CJIS and ITAR. So, you know, compliance, the numbers grow every day. CJIS compliance, 26 states we now have CJIS agreements with. And of these 26 states, they cover 2/3 of the US population, 4 times more than our closest competitor. FedRAMP, we have FedRAMP moderate, FedRAMP high, as I already mentioned. 32 services are covered under FedRAMP high now. So that number seems to increase. I think I did this talk a month ago, I could have given an Azure government talk. That number might have been 26. Now it's up to 32, so the number grows every day. Azure Blueprint, this is another big differentiator for us. For anyone that's had to get an app in compliance and had to, whether you're doing FedRAMP certification or L4, L5, it can be a complex process. And the Blueprint, Azure Blueprint is a process whereby Microsoft helps you streamline the process of getting your app compliant. So a lot of times people might be under a little bit of a misconception that, oh, well, if I deploy my app to Azure Government, I'm compliant, right? Well, no, you are deploying onto compliant infrastructure, yes. So you're already in way better shape than if you were deploying on-prem because you don't have nearly as much to do. But you as a developer still have responsibility to make sure you are exercising certain controls in your app, to make sure encrypting data, to make sure your app is within compliant. Azure Blueprint streamlines that significantly. Okay, just one more word about our DoD regions. So level 5 is extremely important because level 5 is the highest level of compliance you can get for unclassified workloads. And that's a huge differentiator. The idea here is these DoD data centers is that the data in the data center is only for DoD customers, which is an extra level of compliance, which was a question earlier. Okay, Azure Marketplace is another one, over 180 offerings that have been now added to the Azure Government Marketplace. I'm gonna show this a little bit as we go through the talk. And just the amount of services that have been added to Azure Government in the last, let's say, 3 or 4 months. You know, if you're someone that looked at Azure Government a year ago and said, oh, okay, we have websites, we have some databases, some very basic blob storage, but in the last 3 to 4 months alone, the amount of services that have come online on Azure Government and the parity that we are now getting much closer with compared to Azure Commercial is really astonishing, the difference that have come, particularly in the last 3 to 5 months. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about Microsoft and open source, because Microsoft's a company that's been around for a while. And when you start going back 10 years and 20 years, it has not always had the best history in the open source community, which is why if you haven't stayed up to date with what Microsoft has been doing for the last 5 years, some of the things I may show you in this talk may come as a surprise. If you have been staying up with what Microsoft has been doing, maybe you won't be that surprised. But Microsoft, open source at Microsoft has become a huge priority. This is not just words, as I hope to prove to you as I go through the presentation today. First and foremost, Microsoft is now the number one contributor to GitHub. I think that bears repeating. Microsoft is now the number one contributor to GitHub. Okay, think about what we're saying here, people. Like, GitHub is the bastion of open source collaboration and the place to go for open source development in the world. And Microsoft is now the number one contributor. Now, I can see a couple of your faces out there. You don't believe me, so I better prove it to you. So let's come over here to GitHub's own report. And this is the report, the yearly report they release every year. As we scroll down through some of these, oh, right there, VS Code, a Microsoft-funded open source project, or Microsoft-organized, I should say, one of the most highly popular GitHub repos in the world right now. I'm going to scroll down a little bit further, and these are the languages. Of course, probably not going to surprise anyone that JavaScript is the number one open source language. Oh, look at that, C# is in the top 15 of, these are the repositories by language in GitHub. And even in the top 15, TypeScript, 250% increase from last year. Okay, probably a lot of that channeled by Angular. So right off the bat, you can start to see Microsoft is getting its fingerprints on this. We scroll down a little bit further here. We're gonna see our organizations with the most contributors. And right at the top, we see Microsoft leading the way for the first time. And look at some of the names Microsoft's on top of there. Facebook, Docker, Google. I mean, that's some pretty impressive names that Microsoft is in front of now. If we click on this, we can see that here's a GitHub repository for Microsoft, and many of these repositories you may have heard about. VS Code, I just mentioned, TypeScript, a compiler for JavaScript, the new cross-platform .NET Core that can run on a Mac, right? ASP.NET running on a Mac, Visual Studio running on a Mac. I mean, it's a brave new world out there, people, okay? And so I know I have a dark GitHub theme here. And we have right here, opensource.microsoft.com. You can click that if you go to the github.com Microsoft, and you can you can explore all of the various open source contributions that Microsoft has. Also interesting is that when a new software development project starts at Microsoft today, the developers actually have to fill out a form. Is your project open source? Does your project have to be open source? Is it open source? Like every project that starts up, and the development team makes a decision. Yes, we're building an open source project. We're going to develop in the open, like the ASP.NET team, for example. And every team goes through that process. Doesn't mean every single software development project at Microsoft is open source, but the fact that they ask that question before every project, that's pretty incredible. And of course, I encourage anyone to go to this website and explore some of the things that Microsoft has been doing. Okay, so it's, like I said, a brave new world in terms of open source. What you're gonna see is that when we talk about the investments that Microsoft has been doing here, this has been, Azure is a lot of this, and a lot of this can be traced back to when Satya took the helm as the CEO of Microsoft. But even before that happened, there was already so much momentum at Microsoft going the open source direction. You see a lot of the open source innovation the ASP.NET team was doing, they really led the charge, and Scott Guthrie, who's now in Satya's old job. So you can see a lot of that momentum has already been in place. It's been years in the making, and Microsoft didn't just wake up and was number one on GitHub one day. No. That number was born from years of changing the tide at Microsoft. So why does Microsoft care about being the number one contributor or to GitHub why does Microsoft suddenly care about this now? Well, there's a few reasons for it. One is, and there's a few different categories of classes we're going to look at here. So first, when we look at Microsoft's products. So one product you may have seen announced SQL Server on Linux, right? I mean, that in itself is mind-blowing. If you transition yourself 10 years ago in time, the idea of SQL Server on Linux is not something you thought would ever happen. But here we are, SQL Server on Linux. We have the Windows subsystem for Linux, which is really an awkwardly named offering. It's just a way of saying you can run Linux natively on Windows. That has become a thing in the last year. HD Insight, which enables you to spin up a Linux cluster of HD Insight. Maybe you want to run Spark, Big Data. In fact, I'm going to show a demo of that a little bit later as we go. These are all products that Microsoft has brought to market on open source technologies. As far as offerings, you heard me mention earlier the Azure Marketplace. These numbers that are on the slide are actually based on Azure Public, but for Azure Government, the numbers basically hold in that 60% of images in Azure in the marketplace are based on Linux, 60%. And one out of three VMs in Azure run on Linux. Now, the numbers are slightly, I think, below that in government, but they're comparable. So you can see that Azure is not just some place you go to run Windows in the cloud, all right? Microsoft wants Azure to be the place where you run your workloads in the cloud. If you want your workload to be on Windows VMs, great. If you want your workload to be on Linux VMs, great, right? Microsoft wants to provide a first-class environment to all of those workloads. So we'll talk about Linux a lot. Microsoft wants the Azure cloud, government or otherwise, to be Linux to be a first-class citizen in that cloud. Some of the partnerships Microsoft has is key. Partnerships with Red Hat, for example. So it is so easy to spin up Linux VMs on the Microsoft cloud. A partnership with the Linux Foundation, and even some Microsoft employees. We look at someone like Ross Gardler, who's currently the president of the Apache Foundation and also a full-time Microsoft employee. And he, in fact, has a team at Microsoft that works to make sure that Microsoft is, you know, properly innovating on open source technologies and we're being you know, good contributors to the open source community at large. And you know, when you see 600 million lines of code on GitHub, that's no small feat. Okay. So when we talk about Microsoft's approach, so there's a couple of aspects to it. So when we talk about enabling, we're really trying to enable these technologies. So whether, you know, when you talk about Linux or being able to run other languages like Node.js or Docker, whatever, you know, platform or language you want to be able to run, we want to enable that in the Azure cloud. This second box, integrate. A lot of these are database technologies. You know, a lot of times we think database, we think, oh, we're Microsoft SQL Server. But you have all these other things. You have MongoDB, you have Redis Cache, you have Hadoop. Maybe you want to integrate with Docker. So this is another component. Also, what are the technologies? What are the key technologies Microsoft's going to release in this third box over here? So you can see we have .NET Core, Roslyn, TypeScript. So the Roslyn is this open sourcing the C# compiler. And we have .NET Core, which is the Microsoft .NET Core framework running cross-platform on Windows, on Linux, on a Mac, and just some of these other open source releases as well. And then finally, participating in the community. It's not only that Microsoft will release these open source technologies and say, okay, we're gonna create .NET, and we're gonna do it on GitHub, and we're gonna make this open source. Yes, that's great. But in addition to that, Microsoft employees participate in these communities. So they'll participate in the Docker community. They'll participate in the Linux community. And that's another, that participation, that genuine participation is another aspect where Microsoft has really embraced open source. And we think about Azure specifically, there's kind of a continuum here. So this middle section that I just highlighted, each category, Microsoft has their own answers to each of these technologies. So for example, infrastructure, yes, we have Windows Server. And you could run all this stuff on-prem. Data, we have SQL Server. Frameworks and tools, of course we have .NET, the .NET framework, and we have Visual Studio that you can use, and on up the stack. And all these things you can use on Windows machines, on Microsoft hardware, you can do it all on-prem, and that works great. But what if you don't want to use Windows Server for your OS? Maybe you want to use Ubuntu or Linux or any of these other offerings here. We want to enable that. Maybe you don't want to use SQL Server for your database. Maybe you want to use you know, MySQL or SQLite or one of these other offerings, MongoDB. We want to enable that. Visual Studio, maybe you're not Visual Studio users. Maybe you guys write Node, or you want to use Eclipse and write Java code. Microsoft wants to enable that. Whatever your workload may be, Microsoft wants to enable the Azure cloud to be a place where you can run those workloads. Okay, and there's a few. I'll just go through these pretty quick. Right off the bat, there's a few workloads that are critical. So, running, for example, an enterprise Linux cloud infrastructure. Yes, we want to enable that by having enterprise-grade support for Linux distributions, and there's already technology partners in place to make that happen with Microsoft today. Maybe you have a dev test environment, and you want to be able to increase developer productivity because you want to be able to spin up a dev test environment very quickly without having to provision a bunch of hardware for your developers to then get started testing or developing. No, just want to push a button and spin up a bunch of VMs. We want to enable that. And maybe these VMs are not just Windows machines. Maybe they're Linux machines. Whatever the case may be, that's something that Microsoft wants to enable. Java enterprise platforms. You want to be able to reap the benefits of being able to spin up a cloud environment very quickly, but you're a Java shop, and maybe you have a different platform. That's another key differentiator for Microsoft. LAMP and mean-powered applications. So the mean stack is very popular these days. MEAN, Mongo, Ember, Angular, and Node. So hugely important technology stack in the open source world today. Once again, you can spin up a Linux VM or you want a Windows VM or whatever the case may be. These types of technologies absolutely can use in the Microsoft cloud. Okay, a couple more slides before we get to the demo here. So when we talk about the cloud, it's a new way to think of it. So the traditional model is, I have my dedicated infrastructure. I have to stand up my hardware. I have to provision my machines. And I have to build everything to the specifications. I have to estimate my electricity costs. I mean, down to the wire. With the cloud model, it's more loosely coupled. You start getting into microservices. You don't focus on hardware the whole time. You can focus on, you know, maybe what SKU of VM you might be running, but you're more so focused on a DevOps in an agile, you know, service-oriented way. And it's really that thing that allows you to have better automation as you start to standardize your processes. And we think about that continuum when we talk about the cloud being a new way to think about the data center. If you go from left to right, you have two different ends of the spectrum. So on the traditional model, you're going to stand up a bunch of virtual machines. And these virtual machines, you have complete control over the operating system, and you're responsible for it. You've got to patch that operating system, and you've got to make sure that you give it the care and feeding, and you have to do everything yourself. Now, you can go one step further, and you have VM scale sets. And VM scale sets are, we all look alike. We're a bunch of VMs. We look alike, and we can kind of scale these VMs, and it gives us a little bit more throughput. So you get a little bit better bang for your buck. But then you get a little bit further, and you can start bringing in things like containers. Maybe you're talking about Docker containers and Swarm and orchestration, and you start bringing in those, and you can start using more efficient use of resources and even go down to the service fabric level. So Microsoft has its own offering called Service Fabric, which conceptually has many ideas and similar with containers. It's the idea of being able to let the infrastructure decide for you how you're provisioning your resources, or how you can have rolling upgrades or self-healing of applications. And once you start getting over to the right side, this is where things really start getting interesting. Because what happens a lot of times, you say, okay, I need to save taxpayer dollars. I need to cut costs. So I've been told getting to the cloud is a good way to do that, right? But then what happens? You lift and shift all your stuff over to the cloud, and your cloud, what you have in the cloud looks pretty much like what you had on-prem, and the cost doesn't necessarily look that much different. And why? It's because you're sitting there with hundreds of VMs, and the VMs are probably sitting there at 1% CPU, 2% CPU. That's not an efficient use of resources. So when you start getting over to these other higher level services in the clouds, like containers, whether you're talking about Docker containers or you're talking about Microsoft Service Fabric, that allows you to have different type of what we call density. So let's say you have 30 VMs, and you know there's three applications that take, you know, 80% of your workload for your organization. So you can take 20 of those VMs and put three of those applications across 20 of those VMs. And then the remaining 10 VMs can do the other 40 applications, whatever the case may be. Maybe you want to run, you know, 10 applications on two VMs and one application on 20 VMs, because that's the high throughput application. That's the one. And so you can tune your applications so that your CPU is not sitting there at 1%. You also don't want your CPU to be sitting there at 90%, right? But if you can hit that sweet spot where you're feeling like, oh yeah, I'm using 50% CPU, 60% CPU, now you're making a lot more intelligent business decision in terms of how you're spending your money, because you are packing those VMs more tightly in terms of resources, but you have these higher level services like containers and service fabric that is enabling you to make sure you have a good watch on the health of your application. You can scale up and down seamlessly as you span the life of your application. So these concepts here are true whether you're using open source technology or not. But when you do start looking at some of the open source technologies like containers, they can enable those types of scenarios. Okay. Let's do some demos here. So I'm going to flip over here to the Microsoft Azure Government Portal. And I don't know how well that dark theme comes through. So I can just double click and I can change my theme, okay, if you guys already knew that. And you know I'm in the Azure Government Portal instead of the regular Azure Portal because, well, for one thing, it says Microsoft Azure Government right there. And number two, the URL says .us, not .com. So I've said Linux a bunch of times. So the first thing is let's go spin up a Linux VM. So I'm just going to click New. And you can see right by clicking New, I can say search the marketplace. I can just type in Linux here. And look at all the results that come back. And I'm in the Azure Government marketplace right here. Let me load more, okay. Scroll down more, load more, scroll down, right. So I could just keep going down and I keep load more, load more. There's a lot of Linux images just sitting there in the Azure Government marketplace waiting for you to provision. So I'm just gonna select Red Hat 7.3 and click Create, all right? Now, when I do this, I just have some basics that I can put in. So let's just call this Michelotti Tech Summit. What is it, Monday? And let's just give it a username. I could give it a SSH public key, but I'm just gonna give it a password for simplicity. I need a couple more characters. Okay, well, let's try it one more time. No one get nervous. Okay. I know everyone gets uncomfortable when like you see the red check boxes. Don't worry, people. I got it. It's okay. All right. So we have the password here, a subscription. I'm going to spin up a new resource group. Let's call it Tech Summit Linux RG. Okay. So a resource group is just a logical container of resources. And we can select our location, let's say US Gov, Virginia, and we can click OK. And then we can come in here and choose a machine size. So let's click View All, and we can see we have various choices we can make for the size of our VM. Let's just select DS2. Some additional settings here. These are like for our storage account and our VNets and subnets. I'm just gonna select the defaults here, and it's gonna do some basic validation. Yep, am I good? I'm gonna click OK. All right, provision of VM. Now, this is actually probably going to take 5 minutes to run, so I'm not going to sit here and watch the progress bar for 5 minutes. So I actually have a Linux VM that I've already provisioned, and it is, which one did I just do? Tech Summit, so I think it's right here, Michelotti Linux Gov RG. So this is what, if we wait 5 minutes, this is what it's basically going to look like here. And you can see I have a few resources already in here, the storage account where I can store my disks. You have a virtual network that got spun up. There's my VM right there, Michelotti Linux VM1. Then I have network interface, public IP address. So let's actually go to this, and actually let me show this network security group right here. If I look at the network security group, this is the thing that allows us to control our ports and what permissions we have to do our network traffic. And you can see that this is allowing port 22 right here. And the reason it's allowing port 22, because that's the port that we do SSH on. So I'm going to SSH into this box, and I am going to grab the public IP address right here. I'm just going to come over here and copy that, copy. And let's open PuTTY and paste in the IP address here. And let me type in the username and password. Hopefully I didn't make any typo there, and I didn't. Okay, so now I am SSH into the box. I can run commands here, so PWD to print the working directory. I can go back a couple levels. I can, you know, just do a listing, all right? And I can just run commands on the box. If I want to see the file system disk space usage, I can do a df. I can see the top processes that are running on the machine, okay? So you can just come in, and I've SSH into the Linux VM, and I can run commands. Yes, sir? Speak up a little bit. Yes, the question is, can I provide my own Kickstarter file for the Linux machine, for example? Absolutely, absolutely. And the thing is this, you know, I just spun up an image from the gallery, the Red Hat Linux image. You can bring your own image. So if you already have your image, which it sounds like you do, great. Bring that image to Azure Government. It's already got everything installed that I want. I don't necessarily want to make it available to the marketplace for anyone to use. I just want to use it for my organization. Great. Bring your own images, and you can deploy those to Azure Gov. Yes?
At any point of time, is there any version difference between the Azure Cloud and the image?
All right, so your question is a difference between the version of the Azure Government Cloud and the version of the image? Yeah, so the question is a concern over what version of the image I'm bringing to Azure versus what version Azure supports. I understand the concern, but right now, right now there's a whole host of versions that are currently available. I don't have the exact list memorized, but for the most part, we say you can bring virtually any version. Now, if you're bringing a version 20 years old, I can't guarantee that's going to be supported. But work with us, and we will support virtually any version. Did you have one more question in the back, or was that it? Yes, there is a trial, absolutely. Yes, there's a government trial as well, yes. You can get my contact information after the talk. I can get you streamlined into that. The question was about free trial. A lot of times people think of free trial for regular Azure. Not quite as easy for government because we have some vetting that we do. I won't call it extreme vetting, but we have vetting. Sorry, I couldn't resist. But we do have some vetting that we must do to make sure we maintain the integrity of our government cloud. So, okay. So there is our Linux example here. All right, now we talked about we've talked about Linux. I want to jump over to several different technologies as we go through here. And I want to show some Microsoft. I'm going to bounce between Microsoft open source technologies, and we'll come back to some non-Microsoft technologies. So I'm a web developer, and I really love the innovation that the ASP.NET team has done over the last couple years. So I want to show a .NET Core app. But of course, I have to do this with a little bit of a twist here. So we are going to, do this with Angular. We're going to do this with Angular. So we have, we can run the .NET command line tool. So this is our cross-platform .NET command line tool. And I can create a new, let's create a new directory here. Let's call it, Tech Summit Core. Did I spell that right? That's close enough. Okay. And I'm going to cd into this. I'm going to say .NET new Angular. So we can actually give custom templates here for the .NET new command. So this is not just saying spin up an ASP.NET project. It's actually saying, okay, we're going to spin up an ASP.NET project with Angular. And I just do a dir, and it's just generated all these files for me just by running that command. And I can run a .NET restore. So if any of you are Node folks in the room, this is like an NPM install, but for .NET. That's what happens when we run a .NET restore. We say, okay, bring down the packages that are that project's dependent on. And with that, we can come in and say, let me open this in code. I'll say code dot, which means open VS Code in the current directory. So this is VS Code, which is Microsoft's free open source, probably one of the most popular open source project in Microsoft right now. And this runs cross-platform. It can run on a Mac. And I've just opened the application that I just scaffolded on the command line in 2 seconds, probably less than that. Here's my ASP.NET Core project, and I've just opened it in VS Code. Now, I'm also going to run an NPM install just because I'm that brave, okay? Not many people will go on stage and run NPM install because who knows how long this is going to take, right? But I'm brave enough to do it. While that's running, because we know that's going to run for 10 minutes. No, it'll probably run for 2 minutes. Let's just examine a little bit about the application that was just created. So on its surface, it looks like a regular MVC application. So we have home controller right here, and this is very boilerplate C-sharp code. Yes, we have C-sharp IntelliSense in a cross-platform editor, but it's also an Angular app. So if we come in here and look at the client app right here, we can see that, okay, there's the app module, there's my components. Let's see, if I go to the app module, I can see I have Angular routing built in here. So I have some various views, different pages in my Angular application. What's also really interesting about this project is this is a project started by someone on the ASP.NET team that uses what was called JavaScript services. What that enables you to do is pre-render your Angular app on the server before sending it down. So what happens a lot of times is, most of the time for an Angular app, here's your HTML and here's your JavaScript. Okay, now I've got to, now the browser's got all the HTML, now let me go out and make an AJAX call to actually get the data, then come back, and there's a couple of round trips that have to happen with a typical single page application like an Angular application. Whereas if you just rendered everything from the server, your initial page time for that first page would have been faster, definitely faster perceived performance as well as faster performance. Well, the only way you can render an Angular app on the server is if you execute the JavaScript on the server, which you would need a technology like Node for. So what JavaScript services allows you to do is actually, in your C-sharp code on the server, make a call over to Node, execute the Angular application server-side, and then send that HTML all down to the server. That's actually pretty significant stuff. That's pretty cool stuff, all right? And this is what's happening. So I use this example because it's combining several open source technologies in one place. .NET, Microsoft's open source cross-platform web technology. Angular, Google's cross-platform technology. Node, to be able to run JavaScript server-side. And this is all happening in this one open source package. Okay, let's see if our NPM install is done. Yes, it is complete. We're looking good here. And let's also make sure I'm just going to do a quick check on my environment variable here. So let's say ASP.NET core underscore environment. Make sure it's set to development, and yes, it is. So with that, we can just run it, .NET run, all right? So we're running our .NET application. I'm just running it locally for right now, just to make sure it runs and to prove ourselves that, yes, we built an Angular application. So this looks like it's running on localhost 5000. So let's take that, localhost 5000, and 3, 2, 1. Here it is, okay. So here's our Angular application, and here I have my Angular routing, there's the counter, I have a little Angular event handler right here, and I can see that we've spun up that Angular app just locally. Now, that's all well and good, but I also wanna show how can we deploy this app to Azure Government. Because this isn't just an open source talk, I wanna show you how you leverage these things on Azure Government. So let's flip over here back to the Azure Government portal. And I'm going to go to App Services, and let's just fire up a new website real quick. I'm going to add a brand new Azure web app on Government. So we'll just click Create, and let's call this Tech Summit Core. And we'll create a new resource group. Let's just call it the same thing, Tech Summit Core. And we're just going to click Create. Now, what's happening here is In the first time, I provisioned a Linux VM, a virtual machine. I'm provisioning the machine. That's IaaS, that's infrastructure as a service. Now what I'm doing is I'm provisioning an Azure website. The VM is hidden to me. That's abstracted from me. This is platform as a service. This is these higher level services. So sure, I guess there's a server and it's complete, right? I didn't have to wait 5 minutes for that VM to complete. You just saw it, it went green right there. It's already complete, it's already provisioned. And so just within 10 seconds, I now have this website that's spun up in the Azure Government Cloud. And it even has a URL, all right? So if I click on it here, I can see there it is. I can click on the URL, here it is. TechSummitCore.AzureWebsites.us, all right? So it's this blank, you know, one screen, blue screen thing. But within seconds, I was able to spin up this website in the government cloud. So I'm gonna come back to the portal here, and I'm gonna click this button that says Get Published Profile right here. All right, I'm just gonna click that. That's gonna go to my downloads folder. Now, at the same time, let's come over here and let's open Visual Studio 2017. And I'm actually going to open that project that I created that you saw me bring up in VS Code, this right here. Notice it actually did generate a CS prod file, C# project file. So let's actually open this same project, but let's open it in Visual Studio. So I'm gonna right click, open project or solution, and let's go, there it is, Tech Summit Core. This is what I just generated. So now we're opening this in Visual Studio. We're gonna see the same directory structure that we saw in VS Code. Here it is right here. Let's give it another couple seconds to load. And now watch what I'm gonna do. I'm going to right click on this project, this web project, this .NET Core Angular app, and I'm gonna click publish. And I'm gonna come over here to the publish. Ooh, I'm gonna unpin this so I get some more real estate here. And I'm gonna say import profile, and I'm gonna grab out of my downloads folder that publish settings profile that you just saw me download from the portal. That publish profile, that's that handshake I can get to the portal. That's got the information I need to be able to deploy this to the portal. Okay, and with that, it's already started publishing. So we can see we've got a progress bar down here, and it's now publishing that to the Azure Government Cloud. Now, this is gonna take a few seconds longer than the typical web publish because that NPM install, as much as I love Node, the NPM install can sometimes take some time, so we'll give that an extra 60 seconds or so. But let me just show you real quick, that downloads folder where I downloaded that that publish settings, let's open this in VS Code just to look at it. It looks like a jumbled mess here, but basically what you're gonna see here is these are some of the things you need, like our password to be able to publish into the government cloud. This is what was generated for me automatically when I provisioned that website, all right? So we'll give Visual Studio another few seconds to run here. But what's happening here is stepping back from like what's going on in this demo, we're using several open source technologies. .NET Core, open source by Microsoft. It's using Angular in the project, which is also using Node on the server side. And we just deployed it to the Azure Government Cloud right here. It's deploying, or in fact, I'm gonna flip away from this screen for a second. I'm gonna go back to this screen. This is the blue screen that, I just want to prove to you this is the same. Look at the URL, techsummitcore.azurewebsites.us, right? I'm gonna just hit the refresh button here. Boom, all right? So I've deployed that app that's using Angular and Node on the server. So in the Azure Government Cloud, we're running Node on the server, interacting with ASP.NET Core on the server, and sending back this Angular application. And I provisioned it in just 1 minute. Yes?
So that Angular, is that a template?
So the question is, the Angular template that I use this command, .NET new Angular. What happens is that the .NET command line tool is extensible. You can give your own templates. And that Angular template is a template that was built for the ASP.NET team. It was built by the ASP.NET team for us. Nice of them to do. I can use their template now. In addition to that, if you have your own template you want to create, you can also author your own template and you can use that. So whether you want to create your own template or you want to use a template that someone else got, you can use it. So if you just go out and install the .NET command line tool, it won't be there automatically. But when you add one command, you say, hey, I want to grab this template that the ASP.NET team did, the Angular, because I like that, You can go grab it and install on your machine, and then you can do .NET new. I saw one other question. Yes?
So how can you automate the deployments, for example, Visual Studio Team Services, also accessible, like Gap Cloud accessible from the regular team services?
Yes, okay. So the question has to do with automating the deployment, and he's specifically talking about VSTS, Visual Studio Team Services. And you know, if you look at the deployment I just did, I just right-clicked Visual Studio and did the deploy, right? Which works great for a demo, but if you are actually you have a professional project, you want that to be a more automated, perhaps part of a build server process, continuous integration, continuous deployment. VSTS, you may have VSTS in public right now, but you can have a deployment target that goes to Azure Government. Now, in VSTS, as of today, you don't see an option that explicitly says Azure Government. However, you can still trick VSTS into doing it because you can get the data you need from this published profile. So we can work with you on that to automate it. The answer is yes, you can automate that deployment from VSTS. Today, you can do it with a little bit of manual work. In a few weeks or months, we will make that even easier for you. That's coming. But you can do it today. I think I might have saw one other question, or it could have been my imagination. Okay, yes?
Is this service here extensible? So if, let's say, all of this started to bang on it, would it expand?
Ah, interesting question. Okay, so you're talking about the website itself. Okay, so the question is, he's asking, well, you said extensible, but you mean more like, is it how, its ability to scale? Okay, so let me flip back over here to the portal here. And here's my Azure website. So if we had just deployed a website to a virtual machine, and then I said, oh, I'm getting hit by a lot of traffic here, and you know, it's Super Bowl, and I wasn't expecting this many people, even though I probably should have been, because it's the Super Bowl, I gotta spin up a bunch of VMs, but it takes 5 minutes to spin up a VM. Oh, I need to spin up 20 of them. Well, that's gonna take time. And one nice thing about a web app is that you saw it didn't take very long for me to spin it up. Well, what's also nice about having the VM abstracted away from you is a lot of this stuff becomes easier as well. So for example, if we come in here, and man, there's so many options that sometimes you just have to type it in, okay? Scale up and scale out. So when we're talking about scaling to meet a workload, scaling up and scaling out, scaling up is typically meaning, hey, I selected a certain level of machine, so the VM is not 100% abstracted away from you. I still have some, how many cores are on the underlying VM, but you can still do that. So you're talking about scaling up. Usually people are, when we talk about the cloud, is you really want to focus more on scaling out because you're talking about deploying on commodity hardware and you want to be able to take advantage of some of these things. Now, what is the case is if you have Azure web apps in Gov versus public, there are certain auto-scaling options, okay? Now, with Gov, there are some of these options where, and actually, this UI looked a little different a couple weeks ago, but I'm not seeing some of the options right now. Let me just make the long story a little bit shorter. You have auto-scaling in Azure public, and those auto-scaling options are only partially there in government today. In a few months, we are looking to get those, and I cannot give an exact date on that. But when we do get that, the auto-scaling allows you to set auto-scaling a couple ways. One is you can set it on a schedule. You say, hey, I know that I'm running a fantasy football website. It always goes up on the weekend. So I'm just going to, on a schedule, scale it up to 10 instances on Saturday morning, and I'm going to scale it back down to 2 instances on Monday night. Or if you don't want it on a schedule because you don't know when the traffic's going to hit, you can set auto-scaling to be a percentage of the CPU, and you can say, I want to always keep my instances, I want to always keep my CPU running between 60 and 80%. If it goes above 80%, add another instance. Oh, if it's still above 80%, add another instance. And then if it's below 60, take another instance away. And you can set minimums and maximums, like never go below 2 instances or never go above 10 instances. So that auto-scaling is built into Azure Web Apps. There are some things we're still working through to get it in Gov. I don't want to give an exact date, but that is something that is coming. Okay, yes?
I don't see you publish it. How does it
I published it, right? That was what I showed. There it is right here. Look at the URL. This is running in Azure Gov right here. That's published on the server. Here's my site. So that was when I downloaded the published profile. I imported it into Visual Studio. I clicked publish. Boom. Yep. Okay. So let's move on to the next demo here. So I'm going to open a fresh instance of Visual Studio 2017. And you saw me create a project using the command line tools. Now I'm going to create a new project using Visual Studio 2017. I'm actually going to come in here and do every developer's favorite thing, file new project. Okay. And I just want to show you a couple things about this dialog that comes up. So here I'm going to select this option for ASP.NET Core, running an ASP.NET Core right here. And let's just put this in my dev directory. And we'll call this Tech Summit Demo. All right. And click OK. And on this first dialog here, let's change the authentication to use individual authentication. And look at this checkbox right here. Enable Docker support. Literally built into Visual Studio, Microsoft has put Docker support. That's pretty cool. All right. So this is, we're not just put a bunch of stuff on slides saying, yeah, Microsoft likes open source. No, no, no. Microsoft has genuine partnerships with companies like Docker. And we have built-in support in Visual Studio for running Docker in Windows, all right? So let's accept the default and say yes. Let's enable Docker support. And while that's spinning up, let me make sure my Docker's running locally. Yes, it is. Okay, let's kill that. What's that? Yeah. I always have to double check, though. Okay, I never take any chances. Okay. Okay, so let's come here. All right, let's run a Docker PS. All right, nothing's running locally. Everyone agrees. They just saw me run Docker PS. I have no Docker instances running, all right? So now what I'm going to do is I'm going to come over here to Visual Studio, and notice that I have a Docker file that's actually created for me as part of that Visual Studio project. So Microsoft is nice enough to scaffold this ASP.NET project for me. It's got a Docker file. I've got my Docker Compose files up here. So it's put some nice build baseline code here. Additionally, a lot of times when I look at the menu of like where my target's running, I would see like IIS Express. I don't even see that right here because I enabled the Docker support by default. So I actually have a Docker target. So when I hit F5, which is a typical button in Visual Studio, instead of deploying to IIS and running from IIS, it's literally going to run in Docker. So I'm going to do it. Control F5. And if you look really closely, you can see some of the Docker commands down here. But we're actually going to compile this application, run it. It's going to create a Docker image and deploy it to my local Docker instance. Let's give it a couple more seconds here. Okay, there it is. And here it is. I have a home, about, contact. I have a screen running. Notice the port number, 32.769. Let me go back here and run Docker PS again. And sure enough, I have a container running. And look at the port number, 32.769. It's coming from port 80. Now let's make a change to this. So let's say, you know what, I just can't get enough open source technology. So let's add SQLite to this application. So the default is, you know, I can log in and register for my application, and I have a little database that stores the rows for the users of my application. But I don't want to use SQL Server. I want to use SQLite. I don't want to use a Microsoft technology. I want to use some other open source technology. So I'm going to come in here, I'm going to right click and say Manage NuGet Packages. NuGet is like NPM. But for .NET, all right, same concepts apply. So I'm going to come over here, and I'm going to search for Microsoft Entity Framework Core SQLite, and I'm going to add this package right here. And this is just like I'm adding an NPM package, but I'm adding the package for SQLite. And, yep, so I'm going to accept all the defaults. Yes, thank you. Okay, and then I'm going to come over here, and I'm going to just change one line of code in my project because I want to say don't use SQL Server. I'm going to say use SQLite instead. So let's come down here. And right here, you can say use SQL Server on line 44 for the data context. So I'm going to comment out that line of code. And I'm going to replace it with this line of code. So now it's AddDB context. But instead of use SQL Server, it's use SQLite. And there's my database, TechSummit.SQLite. All right. So just like that, Control F5 again, I'm going to recompile my application because I just changed a line of C# code, and I'm going to redeploy it. I have the Docker as the target, so we know it's going to that local Docker container, and it's going to be running .NET Core in a local Docker container. Now I'm going to come in here and register for the app. Now the first time, if not, I actually have to put something here. All right, steve.michelotti@microsoft.com. Now, I don't actually have a database yet, so it's going to give me an error saying, hey, you don't have your database created yet, but I can apply migrations because I'm in development. It lets me get away with this because I'm in development. I'm going to apply migrations, which is basically saying, okay, I'm going to create the database schema for you under the, behind the covers. So now let me refresh the page here. Now I'm going to try this register step one more time. It's just you'll allow me to get away with that because for the sake of the demo. At Microsoft.com. And now when I register, it's going to store my username in the database, and I can log in and log out. Hello, Steve Michelotti, right here. It's actually stored my user in the database. It's running in SQLite. So, I mean, you know, 10 years ago, for you to say, well, I don't want to use SQL Server in my ASP.NET application, and maybe I want to see some other database. You got to do some work to bring in other libraries and that kind of thing. I hope I've convinced you. Like, I go to NuGet, bang, bang, one line of code. No, I don't want to use SQL Server. I'm using SQLite. Microsoft is truly embracing open source technologies, making their technology, which, by the way, is open source, very easy to use with other open source technologies. Okay. We're doing pretty good on time. I want to show a couple more demos here. Was anyone in Tom Keene's demo this morning? A couple people? All right, good. There were some people, yes? Did anyone see me demo Cox services earlier today? Raise your hand if you saw me. All right, a couple people. So you've seen some of this before, all right? Most of the people have not, so good. You'll hopefully appreciate this demo. So another open source technology that we've enabled on the Microsoft Government Cloud is HD Insight. And HD Insight allows us to run clusters of Linux machines, for example, if we want to run Spark, and big data situations, machine learning workloads. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to show you how we can run some basic text analytics on a document. So what I have here is the Azure Storage Explorer, which, by the way, now works for Azure Government. And in here, I've got Blob Storage, and this is the Art of War. It's just the Chinese text, but I've already translated it to English. And if I double-click on this, I just want to show you that, yeah, this is a text file of Notepad, and here's the English translation of The Art of War. All right? So this is sitting in Azure Blob Storage in Azure US Government. You can see the path there, HDI samples, The Art of War. Okay? I just want to prove to you that it's there. So I'm going to come over here, and I'm going to click on HD Insight Clusters, another key open source technology. And if anyone in this room has ever stood up their own cluster of like Spark nodes, it is not a trivial undertaking. And Microsoft, this is a managed service that Microsoft is providing to you. Microsoft is providing this managed service of Linux machines running Spark. And this managed service I'm referring to is what we call HD Insight. So I'm going to click on this Michelotti HDI Tech Summit. And I'm going to click on my cluster dashboards. And there's my Jupyter notebook right there. And you can see I already have some notebooks in here. There's the Art of War, which I happen to already have open right here. This location is a location of that text file I just showed you in Blob Storage. All right, so there's the Art of War, the English translation of it. And I just want to do some basic text analytics. I just want to get some basic word counts. How many times does this word appear? What are the words that appear most often in the book? And I just have a little function here to remove the punctuation and, you know, strip out funky characters. And then I'm just doing a split on the space so I can get the individual words. And then I'm just incrementing each time. So you can see X plus Y. Every time we find a word, increment it by one. And I also want to make sure we get just the top results. So anything that doesn't occur at least 10 times, just throw it away. Words that occur at least 10 times or more, yes, we want to keep that in our data set. And then I'm just going to create a little schema for it. So this schema consists of two columns. One is word, and the second column is count. So we have, here's the word, here's the count. Just basic word counts all the way down. And then finally, I just want to create a table And we'll call this table top word results, and we'll store the results in that table. And just to prove to you that, yes, this actually created it, let's just run a quick SQL statement. So I'll run SQL select star from top word results. And let's say where count is greater than 50, order by count descending. That's good enough. All right, so let's just run a quick query on that. And we can see, and it'll run here, and we'll get a tabular output. And I can also get a quick visualization on it. All right, I should have kind of pre-cached this before the demo starts, but we'll just give this a second. But what's happening here is, because I use the Azure Government Cloud, and again, I always like to prove to you, yes, I'm not running Azure Public, this is the governmentcloud.us right there on the extension. We spun up a cluster of nodes in Azure Government. They're running Linux. So if we come back here and look at the cluster configuration, we can see this is Spark 2.0 on Linux. And it's running, I think we have two head nodes, two worker nodes, and it's running these workloads. And I can just spin up a Spark notebook. And for you to, and then, oh, you're done with the analysis, you're done with the cluster, okay, kill it, just take the whole thing down. So you can spin it up when you're using it. Oh, but this is expensive. These resources, you might have spun up 20 machines. You're done using it? Okay, destroy the whole cluster. You want to come back tomorrow? Okay, fine, spin it up again. Pay for what you use, all right? This is taking some time to run, so I'm going to go on in the next demo, and we'll come back and see what hold on. It's saying not connected. Why didn't anyone tell me I was getting this red thing here? All right, let's try it again. I'm just going to click it from here. Yes, okay. Now let's try it again. And there we go, okay? So there's the results. The word the occurs more than any other word. We can filter out some of those filler words. We can see a nice little HDI visualization here, or I shouldn't call it HDI. This is a Jupyter visualization, a little pie chart of how the words are. HD Insight, Spark, Jupyter Notebooks, another cool open source technologies. Okay, now I can't give an open source talk without showing Node, all right? So let me just do a quick example of Node. Oop, did I just close that? Come back. All right, so I'm gonna come back here to my dev directory here, and let's make a new directory for Tech Summit Node. Let's cd into this. Okay, so I can use a cross-platform Azure command line tools. So I'm just gonna type Azure here, and it's gonna give me just the simple help menu. We got our nice little cheesy ASCII art here up the top, which is pretty cool. And I'm gonna say Azure login, because I wanna be able to administer these commands from the command line rather than having to always go to the portal. So I'll say username is steve.michelotti@michelottigov.onmicrosoft.com. Now the most important part here is I have to say environment, and then Azure US Government. This is what's going to allow me to authenticate with Azure Government. So that would be the switch I need, which is different than Azure Public. And this is going to allow me to actually execute commands on Azure Government. So a couple things I want to do is, just to give myself a quick little scaffolding start, I'm going to do a git clone from a Node.js starter site right here. So I'm going to do that and cd into it, okay? And right off the bat, what we're going to see is I can open this in VS Code. And when I did my git clone, I pulled down an Ember app running Node, and here's the directory structure that got scaffolded for me. Now, I actually want to push this to Azure, this Azure Node web app. So I can say Azure site list. And I can see, well, what websites are running up in Azure right now? And sure enough, there's that Tech Summit Core site that you just saw me create a few minutes ago. And there's this other one called DC Gov Meetup, which I did a couple weeks ago, and I never deleted it. So we want to create a new one. So I'm going to say Azure site create, and we're just going to call this, let's call it Tech Summit Node app. And we want to say dash dash git to have git integration with this web app. Now this is going to be interesting, because this is not GitHub, it's Azure hosted Git. Integration, it's okay, what's your location? We'll say 2 for Virginia, since it's closer. So it's doing a couple things here. It's actually provisioning that website in Azure, which is not dissimilar to what you saw me do in the portal earlier, and it's actually going to have some Git integration. So I have a repository for my source code. So now what I can do is I can just say Git push Azure master, okay? And it's taking this, got to re-authenticate here. It's taking this local directory I have and that's pushing it to Azure. So before you saw me push via that published profile that I use in Visual Studio, I'm just showing you that there's different ways to actually do it. So here, I'm doing it with Git integration. So here's this Node application that I'm pushing to Azure Government with Git. So we have all these open source technologies that are combined. So you notice I didn't say Azure deploy, I said Git push, but because that Git repository is integrated with the Azure Government web app, it knows how to do that automatic publishing. So we talk about like continuous deployment and that kind of thing. So let's do this now. So let me do Azure site browse, okay? And that's gonna launch this in my browser, okay? So here's my Tech Summit Node app. That's the site you just saw me create. And there it is, it's been deployed. Express, welcome to Express, but wait, there's more. So let me come back to this app that you saw me just produce here, index.jade, and there it is, welcome to Express. Let's add a new P tag down here and say DC Tech Summit. Bang, bang, okay? I've just made a line change to the code. Let's come back to our command line. And let's say git add, so it adds any changes we just made, meaning that one line you just saw me add. Let's be good citizens here, git commit m, changed main message. And now let's say git push Azure master. I haven't run any Azure deployment commands, I just said check into my source code. Check into my source code. And by virtue of checking into my source code, it says, aha, you must want to do another deployment, continuous deployment, which is awesome for development environments, right? I don't want anyone walking out of here and saying, Michelotti says, anytime a developer checks into code, I should deploy to production. No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying if you're running development environments, continuous deployment is an awesome thing to do. So, and you can see it's been done. So if I come back here and I look at my Azure US Gov web app here, I'm going to hit refresh. And when I hit refresh, we're going to see that we actually have a new instance deployed of the application right there, DC Tech Summit, bang, bang. Because a developer made a code check-in, and maybe we had other things going, we wanted quality controls, code standard check-ins, whatever we want to integrate in our process, and automatic deployment to the server. Okay, one final thing I want to show, and I'll take questions. Let me show one final thing, is back to the marketplace here. A lot of times people just want to stand up a simple WordPress blog. Maybe it's just an internal thing. They want to, you know, not even something that maybe is publicly accessible. You can see we have templates for that. All right, I can click create. And again, it's a situation where I don't want you to sit here and wait 5 minutes to watch it deploy. But you can see that it's the exact same UI that you saw me deploy the other Linux VM on earlier. So I've already deployed this. And here it is, Michelotti Gov WordPress. So WordPress, again, open source technologies. You have MySQL running behind the scenes. What is it, Python? I've already forgotten now. And here I have my Linux VM right here. So this is a Linux VM, not a Windows machine. I have my storage accounts. I have my public IP address. Let me just go to my public IP address here. And I'm going to copy this, copy. Open a new tab, HTTP, paste. All right, I'm just pasting that public IP address. WordPress blog running in Azure Government on Linux, yet another open source technology. So, what I'm let me pause here. You had a question?
So that.
Yeah. So the question is the fact that I was able to set up the Git continuous delivery. How did I set that up? Did it come from the dash dash git? Yes. Yes.
What size VMs are you
When you say automatically pushing out, you're just talking about Azure Gov in general?
Yeah, when you're doing these templates right here.
So when I'm doing the templates... So it's your choice. Yeah, so the thing you gotta remember is that you wanna separate the template from the VM. You're still in control of that. So let me actually go back to that WordPress example here. So when I, let me say new, and let me say WordPress. So let's just go ahead and click create, because I want you to see the choices. So let me just put in some, all right, I wanna get to the next blade here so I can show you, okay? And we'll just put in like a password. So on the size, this number 2 where it says size right here, this is where you're picking your VM. You're still in control of this. So, and actually, why is this? Oh, okay. Yep. Okay, yep, good. All right, 2. All right, so when I go to the VMs, yes, it may... Oh, thank you. See, there you go, right? So there's two answers. One is we keep our documentation relatively up to date, so you can look at what VMs are there. But in addition to that, there's also the fact that you still have your choice, right? I just want to get here so you can see that you have your choice. So when I get to size 2, yeah, there's all these ones that are showing you. So you have DS1, that's one core. That's not going to be expensive. Here's 2 cores. Here's 4 cores. And... of course, the further down we scroll, it can get expensive, right? So we have some pretty big VMs, $7,000 a month for this one VM with 32 cores. But the point is, you're still in control. Like, just because you pick the WordPress template, you still get your control here and what kind of VM size you're going out on. Okay. So we're hitting our time exactly correct now. So I just want a couple things in closing, a couple things I want to point your attention to. We have our government blog. Someone asked about a free trial, I think. We have our DC meetup that meets once a month. So you'll see me there every month. If please join us. We have a thriving community. We have over 100 people every time. We have 14 Gov sessions today. Hopefully you guys have spent all your day in Gov sessions today. If not, you have a second chance tomorrow. All right, I'll put a couple shameless plugs in for my sessions. I have one on getting beyond lift and shift and using platform as a service on Azure. And then I have another one later in the day tomorrow on cognitive services, where you'll see a bunch of cool demos on like Face API and translation and that sort of thing. So we've hit our time. I'm happy to stay around for questions. I'm also going to be at the Ask the Experts tonight. But thanks, everyone, for coming.